Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 29th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. And we're also joined by our frequent guest, perhaps I should say you both are co-hosts, but anyway, we'll stay with frequent guests for the time being, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, 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 good. So I try and decide which of you is least expectant of being introduced first and throw the force you to say hello for a surprise. So this is, we are now kind of in the aftermath of the March for Our Lives last Sunday, which was a nationwide march, which I think turned out on millions of people across the country. There's something like 500,000 people in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. And of course, the March for Our Lives is a reaction to the terrible shooting down in Florida, at a high school in Florida on February 14th. The kids, this group of high school people, high school kids, presumably with the aid of some adults in the background somehow, set up this march that drew in, clearly touched a nerve, right? Clearly brought in hundreds of thousands of people who cared deeply about this. There was a sister march here in the Boston area, which drew, it was 50, 60,000 people. I was down on the common to see it. And across the country, there were marches. And so I guess when you have a cultural moment like that, where something's happening around a social issue, you want to take stock, right? You want to say, what does this mean for people who are in the climate? What does it mean for the country? Of course, you begin there, right? What does it mean for the country and the issues that are first order? What lessons can we take out of that kind of an event? Let me give you two guys, DR, let me start with you. I'm sure you got a chance to observe some of the activities that were plastered all over TV, right, on Saturday. Mm-hmm. What did you make of the March for Our Lives?
I had two takeaways. The first takeaway was that as momentous of an occasion as it was, it will be interesting to see what sort of political impact it's going to have. I was having a discussion, texting back and forth over the weekend with our friend Betsy Rosenberg, discussing the fact that it got more media coverage than the People's Climate March did 4 years ago. And as momentous as that occasion was, unfortunately, 2 months later, you had climate change deniers win in the House and Senate. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of enduring political impact this is going to have. And the other thing is the moral contrast between the speakers there, especially the young speakers, from a wide variety of backgrounds, and contrast that with some of the venality and the moral tininess, if you will, of the people attacking the march, whether it's the Alex Jones types or the Rick Santorum's types, and just people who could not make any kind of coherent argument in response, so they resorted to some of the most vile ad hominem attacks. We've seen that internet meme, that fake internet meme of Emma Gonzalez tearing up the Constitution, created by right wingers who are trying to sort of inspire the same sort of hatred towards Emma Gonzalez that befell Kathy Griffin when she actually did an anti-Trump mm-hmm. photo, mm-hmm. and it's like just to see the contrast. Of moral strength between the people on the side of good and the people on the side of the opposite of good.
Yeah,
and that reflects too. If you think about how there's the whole thing about politically talking about guns the day of a big tragedy is so politically and is so insensitive to the victims. And then the notorious thing about these victims is they came out and they said, yes, we want to talk about gun violence, and we don't want your thoughts and prayers. We want you to make changes. Mm-hmm. And then, here you have people attacking these people, these children who are victims of a terrible crime, right? Yeah. I mean, so it's such a funny intersection where you have, you know, these students who have said, we're going to make this political because we need change. Right. And then people are attacking them in ways that are not fair to theirs. I mean, these kids are suffering, right? They lost their friends.
Well, I think to DR's point, and to yours, it's like the technique is the same, right? The ad hominem belittling sort of conspiratorial technique of attack is the same, whether you're talking about Obama citizenship, the climate issue, right? It's the, or any of a number of things. It's the same belittling, high school level almost, very effective, but high school level kind of attack. And I think that we should take strength from the fact that this is all they got, right? And if you can parlay the personal attack and somehow turn, which I think these kids are doing, turning it around on its ear in many cases, that's a good thing.
And I think, you know, there's also sort of a commonality with, I think that some of these pro-gun, I don't know how else to say it, but a lot of these folks who are saying protect our Second Amendment rights, there must be part of them that realizes that we shouldn't have rights to an AR-15, and people who have, you know, severe mental illnesses that have, you know, been diagnosed should not have rights to go out and buy a gun easily. I mean, there must be some part of them that realizes that they don't have a good argument against that, just in the same way that they must realize, that a lot of folks must realize, a lot of the deniers, I should say, must realize they don't have a good argument against taking actions to stop climate change and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So you're right. This is why they turn to these sort of juvenile reactions that, you know, create some sizzle but have no real substance to them.
Yeah, I think that there's a great deal of psychological, I think, baggage around the whole gun issue that I still maintain that the passion and the persistence and the passion that these people have about guns is not so much tied to the gun or the Second Amendment or anything noble, but it's fear of loss of their privilege as the people that run society. Right, white guys with guns think they run society, and if that is under threat, then it goes beyond any sort of rationality. They're not arguing rationally; they're just attacking because they feel their very lives are at stake. And I think one way to somehow, I don't know, if you could take the steam out of the issue for these people is somehow reassure them that they will still be fully productive citizens, even if the president's a black guy, right? I mean, that's the driver of the whole thing. I guess what I took, one of the things that I took out of this march, let's go back to Washington, D.C., the march, one of the things that I liked in the presentation, I think that I saw, of course I could be wrong, but there was a significant effort to move the discussion past the idea of white kids getting shot with AR-15s, to the idea of the violence in urban neighborhoods that is chronic and endemic. And I think that's called intersectionality, although I'm enough of a social scientist, but I think that is a fantastic thing that has been done, is bringing those two things together. I don't know, do either of you have a comment on that?
I thought it was very well done how they integrated this conversation into the march, and to have students from backgrounds where, as at least one speaker noted, that, you know, it doesn't make the nightly news when violence happens in certain communities. And in fact, I think it was David Hogg who pointed out that there were any number of articulate African-American students at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School who seemed, their cell phone numbers, for some reason, the mainstream media apparently couldn't quite get all those digits in to try to call them and bring them on television. Yeah. So you can sort of, you know, it was a very skillful way of basically saying that, you know, the gun issue is a proxy for a lot of other issues that, you know, even though, you know, the victims from Marjory Stoneman Douglas, you know, who are on television may, you know, represent a certain social sphere, that the issue of gun violence, you know, reflects inequalities that are already existing in society, that that gun violence disproportionately happens to different groups of people. Right. And therefore, you know, we need to address all of these issues concurrent with the issues of gun violence.
I agree with you that these are other issues that lie at the heart of the issue, and that we should not miss the opportunity to bring them to the front. And I guess this is going a little bit off the topic here, but in relationship to this, what we would call intersectionality, we're bringing in these other issues into the AR, the assault rifle discussion. I saw a thing somewhere, which I'll never be able to find again, but it talked about the fact that the horrible history of lynching and Jim Crow in the United States, it was, everything was fine. It was not mentioned, it was all overlooked until a bunch of Italians got lynched in New Orleans. And all of a sudden, there was white guys getting lynched, and it was in the news, right? And that there was a woman of color, who was able to parlay that media attention into raising the consciousness about that horrible evil from 100 years ago. And I think in many ways, this is the same thing, right? There's this kind of high-profile violence with the assault weapons, which is, God, it's terrible, right? But it then sheds, all of a sudden, the beam of light is shown on all the other kinds of gun violence that needs to be considered in the same way, and that brings in a whole bunch of other issues, right? I don't know. Go ahead.
I think the problem is that the high profile, the high profile AR-15 kind of assaults kill a lot of people, get a lot of attention, and maybe we could do something about them. I could see that action being taken on those more so than banning handguns in neighborhoods where gang violence is prevalent, right? And so I guess my point there is, is some of the challenge that it seems like completely intractable that we would address these kinds of the violence that's happening every day in so many communities.
Well, I think that until you put a shine a light on it and start recognizing it as a public health issue, you're not going to get anywhere, right? And even the AR, the assault weapon thing, seemed intractable until it wasn't, right?
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess, not to go too far down the gun discussion path, I think that the lesson for climate hawks, which I always want to bring us back to, is this idea of intersectionality, that we need to see related issues in the climate and the global warming debate that are orthogonal but connected to the climate issue. I think a couple of weeks ago we talked about environmental justice. There are all these other kinds of things that need to be brought on board into the climate discussion because it's the right thing to do, and it's a way to expand the movement. And I think that this thing that is being done with the March for Our Lives, I think, you guys can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think that is a kind of a template for climate hawks to look at.
Well, I think, a movement is more impactful if it comes together around a lot of issues, right? I think to some degree, some of what dilutes climate change is there's so many different organizations working on so many different aspects of it, and there's not this one unifying organization that is taking charge the way the NRA is, right? The NRA is the most powerful organization in the U.S., and it's not because people march or, people have organizations that are fundraising and trying to do things to, stop whatever. It's because they get people out, they vote them, they get them to vote, they energize them. And, I almost wish that there was, and maybe there is. I mean, I know that we have more moveon.org, and but it'd be nice to have one organization that kind of like is just in charge of getting people out to vote, really to save lives. I mean, right? The commonality certainly is that guns take lives and climate change takes lives, right? And so, mm-hmm. you know.
I guess that goes back to the point, sort of the point I was trying to make before, is that the NRA is successful because it can touch the raw nerve of fear of loss of white privilege at will, mm-hmm. right? They go out and they push that electric, that taser, boom, they hit that nerve, and every joker's out going to buy an assault weapon, right? Because they're terrified. Mm-hmm. The question is, the climate movement is essentially a positive thing. I think we should cast it that way. But there's no, we have not yet identified the sort of raw nerve that makes people go crazy, right? And maybe there isn't one. I don't know. But I think that's the kind of thing that we need to get to, is what's to your point, Mariah, what's the unifying values-based thing that makes people want to go out and vote people out of office if they don't agree with them?
Yeah, that I think that is the million-dollar question for sure. DR did a great, DR enjoyed your Washington Monthly piece, which we could probably link on the blog, right?
We will.
But one of the things that DR put in that piece was a speech of some sort by Barney Frank. And one of the things that he said was, when the left gets mad, we march. When the left gets mad, they march. And when the right gets mad, they vote. And voting beats marching. Right. And that's something that we have to keep in mind. I mean, I think these marches are very important. I think Emma Gonzalez in her speech in D.C. was moving, incredibly moving, and energizes the movement. And these young folks are inspiring and motivating to get everybody out there, right? But we need to get people out that can vote, and we need to get them registered, and we need to get them voting. That's the tactic that the NRA is using, and that's really important.
I think to the credit of the people organizing the march, they talked a lot about voting. And I completely agree. That's the right path. Right, DR, I'm sure you, DR, mm-hmm. I know you've thought about this connection of voting in climate and making things happen, right?
Well, I think we've noted this before, but it does bear repeating that it is the political interests around which the NRA circulates that trafficked in its own form of intersectionality. It was the pro Second Amendment people that recognized that they had to make common cause with the anti-abortionists, and they recognized they had to make common cause with the school with the homeschoolers or the school choice Betsy DeVos mm-hmm. type of voters, mm-hmm. and they all unified around those issues to drive themselves to the polls, and that people on the other side of the political fence, so to speak, have to do the same thing. To unify around a series of issues that will galvanize people to make sure they show up in large numbers, election in and election out.
Yeah.
And so to that end, we had an opportunity at the MCAN conference at the end of the beginning of March, right? Mariah and I, who did we talk to, Mariah, about
Nathaniel
voting?
Stinnett. Yeah, mm-hmm. Nathaniel Stinnett. I think he's with the Environmental Voter Project, right?
Mm-hmm. 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 And basically we put up a discussion around what he told us about how and why to motivate people to vote. And I think it's a very informative thing, especially for all the people, all the smart people listening to this podcast know that they have to go out and get other people to vote. And how are those, you know, how are you, dear listener, going to get someone else to vote? And that's what we will come back to in a future podcast when we talk to Mr. Stinnett, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, we've already consumed 19 minutes and 53 seconds or so, so we're going to have to put it down here. Let me say that we will put up links to most of what we talked about, especially Mr. D.R. Tucker's blog at the Washington Monthly, so that you can read his. If you don't know D.R., if you don't know D.R., he is a marvelous, prolific guy. As I say each week, he writes a lot. He's on all kinds of shows. He does a lot of stuff. So he's a good guy to follow on his Twitter account. Right, D.R.? What's your Twitter account?
D-R-T-U-C-K-E-R.
D.R. Tucker, right? There you go. Anyway, we'll put up links to what we talked about there. You can find us on Facebook if you haven't yet deleted your Facebook account, you can go and find /MassClimateAction. I urge you you can like Mass Climate Action. No one's going to come after you for that. But, man, the Facebook stuff is amazing, isn't it? Really, it's scary. Mm-hmm. Scary. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone, which is probably bugged anyway, but you can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you can listen to us on Apple Podcast, the new version of iTunes, right? You can find us there. So we will close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, DR, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
And Mariah, thank you so much for your insight and wisdom.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll talk to you guys next week. We'll talk to you all next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Very cool.